but not as a priority. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
A new Hawaii law lets the state government ignore repeated requests for President Obama's birth certificate. Hawaii's Republican governor has signed the bill into law. So-called birthers who claim the president wasn't born in the U.S. have been making repeated requests. No such evidence that the president was born anywhere but Hawaii has ever been produced. And Hawaii's state health director says she has seen vital records proving the president was born in the U.S. The Labor Department says first-time unemployment benefits claims are down for a fourth straight week. The department says employers are hiring again, though not at high enough a rate to reduce the unemployment rate. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
It's the middle of tornado season in central Illinois. Here in Tornado Alley, deadly storms can strike without warning. I'm meteorologist Ed Kieser. Learn what's being done to improve warnings and what you can do to protect yourself. Call in with your questions. Watch Tornado with me, Ed Kieser, tonight at 7:30, exclusively on WILL-TV.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we will look at current developments in the American labor movement. We'll try to talk a little bit about where organized labor is today, where the strength is, how perhaps that might have changed in the last few decades, and certainly what the potential is for organizing more of the American workforce. And one thing I'm sure we'll be talking about, one of the biggest pieces of news lately in organized labor, that is the change of leadership at the nation's fastest growing union. That's the Service Employees International Union. Our guest for the program this morning is Bob Bruno. He is associate professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois Chicago, where he's also director of the Labor Education Program. His research focuses broadly on working class and union studies issues. He teaches courses in things like labor and politics, labor history, collective bargaining, has done a lot of writing and speaking on the subject. He's taught many industrial relations courses for trade union members who work in public, private, and professional occupations. He's also a frequent commentator on labor relations for both regional and national media, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions from listeners are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that one, and we'll pay for the call. That is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to share your thoughts and questions with us by email, you may do that and send it along to will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. So at any point here, input from people who are listening, that is certainly welcome. Professor Bruno, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
To begin, maybe we could just talk a little bit in general terms about union membership today, and where is the strength now in organized labor in America?
Well, there have been some significant changes in the makeup of not only the labor force, but the unionized workforce. There is an almost equivalence between workers in the public sector and workers in the private sector, so that about half the workforce is now public sector workers, and where before there would have been a much greater advantage in the private sector. But as the economy goes through crisis and various cycles of change, there has been a great deal of union loss in the private sector. But there has been a sustained movement and even some incremental growth amongst public sector workers, that's state, county, municipal, federal workers. So that's a significant change, and that's an area of growth and an area of significant strength. Additionally, women now make up, again, nearly half the workers who are unionized. Again, that's related to the job markets and occupations that people are not only working in but are being unionized. So that's an important shift. And there's also considerable activity amongst people of color and low-wage workers, the unions which have seen the greatest increase in membership. Have been unions that have represented workers who are lower on the income chain, new immigrants, people of color. And again, that's corresponding to some significant changes that we've seen in labor markets. Mm-hmm. However, there's still quite a bit of vitality in the old line industries like manufacturing, the United Steelworkers, through some mergers and a very exciting movement abroad in which they developed the first international merger of a union in the United States and one in England, has now grown to be the largest manufacturing union in the United States. So quite a diverse group.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we talked about here, and as I said, as far as organized labor is concerned, I suppose one of the biggest stories here that's come up recently, that is the change in leadership at the Service Employees International Union, with Mary Kay Henry becoming the president. And we can talk some, I want to talk some about her and about the SEIU and about the split with the AFL-CIO, all that kind of stuff. But I think it's very striking that when you talked about here that now women make up nearly half of unionized workers, and there has been a lot of activity involving people of color and low-wage workers. And it seems that in some of the things that I have seen that Ms. Henry has talked about, that she thinks for her union particularly that that's where there's great potential for additional organizing right there in that big pool of workers that we're talking about.
Right. And I don't think anybody observing, watching closely the labor movement or the state of labor markets would disagree with that. That's certainly been true now for more than a decade, and it's been the driving principle behind SEIU's organizing success. And Mary Kay also continues really in promoting the principle that is, again, a hallmark of what SEIU does, that the next American middle class is actually embedded within these new immigrant communities, embedded within people of color. And just as coal miners at the turn of the century, steel workers at the turn of the century, and auto workers who then came to be seen as sort of, you know, the leading industrial giants of the labor movement and prime examples of middle-class proletariats, SEIU recognizes that this new immigrant group is where the next middle class is going to come from, and given that, it's where the regeneration of the labor movement is likely, at least in part, going to come from. And Ms. Hudson clearly recognizes that and will, you know, will push that agenda forward as she should.
A little history here, and this is something actually I know that we talked about now going back several years. Andy Stern was the president. He's was the last president of the Service Employees International, who was president for 14 years. And he was something of a controversial figure, I think, within organized labor, because, at least in part, because back in 2005, he pulled his and other, caused the, another a number of other unions to leave AFL-CIO. They formed another association, something called Change to Win. And this was something that many people, I think, who looked at labor and were involved in labor thought was a mistake, that it divided labor and they thought it would reduce its power. He laid out some very ambitious goals for organizing that I'm not sure quite panned out. Just if you look at what happened with that big split there, can we say now, 5 years later, that that was as far as organized labor is concerned, was a mistake?
Well, you know, I think there are a number of ways that you can do the analysis. The critique that SEIU put out there and led, and to be honest, was supported by a number of AFL-CIO unions that remain within the Federation, was an accurate one, that there simply wasn't enough resources being put into organizing, and that principally new tactics had to be used, and the labor movement had to look at new ways of structuring their organizations, freeing up resources, and doing organizing. And it was on that basis that you could, you know, that the labor movement could not continue to just bargain over a dwindling pool of workers, that it had to expand, or it would certainly, you know, reach a point where it would no longer be a relevant economic or political institution. And that critique was an accurate one, and it was one that even the AFL-CIO had done white papers on, going back to the early 1980s, questioning the need to restructure and the need to do more organizing. So the critique, I think, was a fair one. The problem was that the new federation has not really represented a alternative model in the same way that the CIO in the 1930s presented an alternative model to a new group of workers, to the American Federation of Labor, which had been formed first in the late 19th century. And then you had these two models of organizing competing against one another, sometimes in negative and hurtful ways, and that continues true today. But most often organizing the unorganized, and these two models really grew the strength of the labor movement and helped to build the middle class. It's that piece that really hasn't happened. It's hard to sort of see Change to Win as a coherent body that has had organizing successes. There are successes within the unions that make up Change to Win, but those successes likely would have occurred even without the association. So it's not 5 years out. It's not really clear that it generated any significant change in the labor movement. And unfortunately, in the way in which the split was discussed and debated, it degraded into a debate over should we do more organizing or should we do more politics, which was always a false argument. It degraded into personality conflicts. It degraded into just simply questions of money and wanting to hold more of your dues back. And that, unfortunately, I think clouded the more serious discussions that were at the root of the need to make some change.
Well, it seems that, again, what I have read, some of the comments that Mary Kay Henry has made, it sounds as if what she's saying is that what she intends to do is both those things,
yeah.
put significant energy and resources into organizing and continue to work in politics to try to support those candidates that they think share their agenda. Now, does that solve that argument by saying, well, we're not going to do one or the other, we're going to do both?
Well, Ms. Henry is continuing what was done under President Stern, and it simply illustrates the inaccuracy of the dichotomy that was presented 5 years ago. The truth is, by almost every measure out there, SEIU is a significant political player. They're a political player at the national level, evidenced by their relationship with the Obama administration. They're very influential in the state of Illinois, evidenced by their ability to move executive orders and then legislation that extended bargaining rights to home health care workers and child care workers in the state. And so it's never been true that it's been one or the other. So when Ms. Henry argues that we're going to continue to be a political player, but we're also going to put significant dollars into resources, she's simply acknowledging that what the union has been doing and doing effectively, it's going to continue to do. And that never was the real basis for the split. In fact, when John Sweeney and the New Voice slate was elected in 1995, a centerpiece of their platform was, we're certainly going to do more organizing, but we're going to be more politically active because we were embarrassed by the Reagan Revolution in 1994. That was the trigger mechanism for sort of scaring the labor movement into a renewed political focus. And so that happens to be what the AFL-CIO has actually done well since 1995. It's done politics well. So SEIU never left the AFL-CIO because they just felt there was too much money going into politics. They understood the need to do that. They understood the need for labor law reform. But they also thought that you could do both, that you'd have to do it in different sort of ways, and you might have to restructure the organizations. And that's where, unfortunately, there was a lot of nasty argument.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Bob Bruno. He is associate professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois Chicago. He's also director of the Labor Education Program in Chicago. In his work, writing, speaking, he focuses on working class and union studies issues, and we're talking about some of what's going on these days in the labor movement here in the United States. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. That was the toll-free. The email, that's what I'm going for, will-talk@illinois.edu. It was my understanding that at the point when Andy Stern announced that he would be stepping down as president of the Service Employees International, that the front runner to replace him was a woman who is the current secretary treasurer, Anna Berger, and that though fairly quickly Mary Kay Henry emerged as a candidate. She, in her work in the union, she worked in that section where they organize people who work in healthcare. That was where she came from, and she managed to she was elected. And even though it seemed that Anna Berger was the one who was the choice of Andy Stern. Now, I don't know if we're getting too deeply into the minutiae of union politics here, but do you have some insight into exactly how it is that Mary Kay Henry emerged as a candidate and managed to win?
There was a real quick kind of a rush to judgment that or prediction that Anna Berger would be the likely person. President Stern had endorsed that move. It's, however, not that surprising that Mary Kay Henry emerged actually very quickly and very, very strongly, because one of the ways to understand how political leadership unfolds within a union is to look for those divisions or units or constituencies within a big union like SEIU, look for where the largest number of workers are, what industries are they in, and then what key national leaders who have been at the forefront in leading those constituencies. Obviously, the healthcare workers are a significant, if not a majority, block in SEIU. And Mary Kay Henry has her history in embedded in work in those fields. So one, she's known to a large number of workers, i.e. voters. She's also, of course, as a national leader, she's well known and has had working relationships with leadership throughout the union structure at state levels, at county and local level, so she would have built strong ties and relationships with the local leadership. And when you survey any union's executive board, recognizing the working relationships that you have with those other leaders, and you understand what they would perceive as being in their own unit's best interest. You can do that calculus almost like a mathematical formula, someone like Mary Kay Henry would emerge as a very likely and strong candidate. And she has a number of other what would be sort of attractive characteristics that speak to this union's identity. And so at the end of the day, not so surprising. Also, I think a lot of people mistakenly believe that a very strong union president is functioning without any checks and balances, that they function with almost unilateral control. And the truth is, while President Stern was a very strong leader, he did have an executive board that did have to take action. He had a strong hand in forming that executive board, but they, in fact, act as independent officers. And once he stepped down, frankly, they had a constitutional, meaning a union constitutional duty, to act in the best interest of the union. And lo and behold, a democratic process broke out, and it actually breaks out much more often in the labor movement and in unions than, for example, amongst the board of directors of large companies. And so to some degree, it's just a kind of a lack of education and understanding on the general public that they would be sort of surprised by how this turns out.
We have a caller here to bring into conversation. Let's do that in Champaign County, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. Well, I'm rank and file SEIU, and I'm really pretty disturbed with Stern for the split, for one, and a lot of other things, too. Tantamount to union rating, particularly in the medical field, the scandal in California is just absolutely outrageous, the way they were rating and undercutting true union democracy. So I don't know if I'm going to get a sympathetic statement from you at all, but I just think he's and there's a critique of his type of the expansion that has gone into these lower income things is some people deprecate it. I don't know exactly what the expression is, but you know, it's not a real true union movement in the sense that, you know, if you have a complaint, you call an 800 number, and there's an expression for that kind of really sort of bureaucratic kind of unionism that is I think really a large part of the problem. So,
well, I
could fulminate for a while, but I shouldn't let you.
it's actually great to hear from a rank and file member, and the brother actually, I think, speaks to a very strong feeling that does have to be acknowledged by everyone who is either in the labor movement or follows and comments on it, that there is a legitimate debate about the way in which SEIU goes about organizing and representing members, and there should be a way to have that discussion that enhances the capacity of the labor movement to move forward, that doesn't demonize people as either Democrats or autocrats. I think, unfortunately, that's how some of the debate in California has been interpreted. But having said that, the disputes that Stern took SEIU into with UH Healthcare West, which was just a model of a democratic progressive union, and then into battles with other unions, the challenges to unite here, are terribly destructive, terribly wasteful. They do cast a black eye on the labor movement. And frankly, if rank-and-file workers like the brother who calls in are feeling this kind of disappointment and they're showing levels of frustration, it's a real wake-up call. And one would hope that Mary Kay Henry is listening. What I'd like to ask the caller, if he'd be willing to answer, do you perceive Mary Kay Henry as someone who is too much like the old leadership, or is she someone who can make peace and maybe tack the union in a different behavioral way?
Well, I didn't see her stand up in any way and dissent to the rating and that kind of stuff. So
yeah.
It makes me think that she's on board for that, and that's pretty much of a condemnation. I think she's drunk the same kind of neoliberal Kool-Aid that Stern has, and you know, he's going on to be on the Social Security Commission, and I really don't trust him to really take, you know, the labor economics, labor-funded economics think tank seriously, which is they base, you know, the Social Security scandal or crisis is a fraud. It really isn't that bad, and even if there was just some more fair taxation in this country for a lot of things, we wouldn't have the crisis in Medicare even. So it just seems to me that go ahead.
No, I just wanted to compliment you. As a teacher at the University of Illinois and the School of Labor and Employment Relations, we do lots of classes and training for union members and for undergraduates in credit and non-credit settings. And I'm just thinking what a valuable exercise it would be to have union members like the caller actually taking classes in labor studies with our undergraduates. It would just bring a breadth of sort of real-world experience. So,
well, that kind of naturally brings up the fact that some of the retrenchment going on in the university is pretty targeted almost directly at those kind of labor education programs and stuff. And
exactly. That's correct.
I confess a personal friendship with Joe Barry and people that are on the line on that, but that's something that we need more of. It's the worst place to be hacking, it seems to me, in this working class.
Well, I appreciate
the economy we're having. Thank you.
Thank you.
We are at our midpoint here. Let me again, for anybody who's just tuned in, reintroduce the guest, Bob Bruno. He is associate professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations and director of the Labor Education Program at University of Illinois Chicago. Has done a lot of research and writing on working class and union studies issues. Teaches courses in labor and politics, labor history, collective bargaining. He's taught a lot of industrial relations courses for trade union members, people who work in public, private, and professional occupations. Frequent commentator on labor relations, both for regional and national media. And we're talking about current developments in the labor movement here in the United States, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just one thing, we talked a little bit about this split. When Stern took his and some other unions out of the AFL-CIO and formed this other association, Change to Win. I think that some people, when Mary Kay Henry became president of the SEIU, started to ask questions about the possibility of whether they could get back again together with the AFL-CIO. It's something that many people hope for, but still seems kind of a long shot right now. What do you think about that?
It's often more complex than it seems on the surface. While it was pretty clear that SEIU didn't acknowledge any strong rationale or motivation for coming back into the AFL-CIO, unlike a number of other Change to Win unions that have gone back and I think are flirting with going back and likely will. President Stern still had a relationship with key leaders at the AFL-CIO. No two labor leaders could, in their approach and their ideological analysis of what's wrong with the economy or the behavior of businesses in this country, or how the labor movement should behave, then Richard Trumka, who is now the new president of the AFL-CIO, comes out of the mine workers, classic industrial union, a very militant one, and Andy Stern. And while they would both be rather critical about each other's positions publicly, my understanding is they had a relationship and they had conversations. And neither one of them wanted to put their own associations, individual interests ahead of the success of the labor movement. Admittedly, it was sometimes hard to figure out how to get back together. And so I say all of that because the differences, what can appear to be really significant differences one day can completely dissipate, like mist the next day. And Mary Kay Henry, she may have, as the previous caller said, endorsed the fights and sort of acknowledged what Stern was doing. She didn't start those fights, and she wasn't in a position. She wasn't at the top of the food chain. Well, she now is, and since she didn't start the fights, it's more likely that she has the capacity to make peace. And I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that these two will come back. For example, the Carpenters Union, this is my favorite union on this subject, they've gone in and out of the AFL-CIO about 24 times. And right now they're out of it, but they're not really in the change to win. But they do work with the AFL building trades, and they work with other trades, and they work with other change to win unions. So stay tuned. I think a reunification is certainly possible. It wouldn't shock me if it didn't happen during Mary Kay Henry's term.
Mm. One thing that I want to talk about here is the Employee Free Choice Act. Really what we're talking about here is the rules that apply when workers decide or some workers decide that they want to organize and to join a union and have a union represent them in collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. As I understand it now, essentially the rule is that if people – you go into a workplace, people sign up, that if 30% or more say yes – they want a union, that still a separate secret ballot is required, and that now for some time some people have been arguing that that's just it's unnecessary, it's too much, it makes it more complicated, it makes it harder for workers to unionize, and that simply what should happen is if a majority of workers say they want a union, then that should basically be it. Well, now there's been an argument about this in some time in Congress, there has been this legislation, I believe that it's passed the House, that simply would say, you know, if most of the workers sign cards saying they want a union, well, that's it. It's hung up in the Senate. The president supports it. What can we say about this specific legislation, and then maybe also the larger issue of the ability of workers to organize?
A vitally important piece of legislation. It would be the most significant change to the right to organize that was first granted to workers through the National Labor Relations Act in 1935. There have been other amendments since then. The amendments have mostly restricted the right to organize, except for opening an important door to the healthcare field. So this piece of legislation is at the top of labor's political wish list, and if it were to pass, would, if unions were properly prepared to take advantage of the opportunities, and only some are, but assuming they would ramp up to do so, would likely produce a dramatic increase in the percentage of workers who are unionized, and there's all sorts of positive correlates to that happening. So it's a very important piece of legislation, and no surprise, it has become the piece of legislation that the business community has most opposed, more so than bank regulation or other forms of government oversight. This is the one thing that they will kind of bring out the guns for. Labor sees it as critically important that the laws that grant the right to workers are in fact effective and legitimate, and do create the actual right to organize, not just the right to do so by law. Under the current law, as you note, it's not enough for a majority of workers to say they want to be in a union, to express that view by signing a card, if you will, voting once, they now have to vote a second time. And in that second time, the employer has numerous legal and, unfortunately, illegal tactics that they can use to thwart the will of workers. And what, sadly, I think people in the general public fail to understand is that since actually the 1930s, the Supreme Court has ruled that it is perfectly legal and consistent with the law for workers not to be compelled to have an election. If they show a majority interest, they can choose an alternative route, which would be a showing of cards or a showing of a petition, except that, and this is the big hitch, they have to get the employer's permission to do it. So if the employer says, okay, I'm willing to just recognize the card, then a union can be certified without an election. But if an employer says, no, I don't recognize the showing of the cards, and I'm going to compel the election, obviously they compel the election because they think it's an opportunity to defeat the organizing campaign, then they're given that unilateral power. And imagine the equivalency in civic elections if Republican voters would go to the polls, and when they got to the polls, they were told by Democratic pollsters working the polls that they couldn't get Republican ballots or that they had to come back and they could only vote at certain times of the day. If you granted to one party control over the expression of one's political sovereignty, you would completely destroy the democratic process. And that's what exists in American labor law right now. There is no effective right to join a union, and the electoral process is frankly a fraud, and therefore this law, the Employee Free Choice Act, would say it's no longer up unilaterally to the employer to determine whether or not a majority of workers who have expressed their will should have that will enforced. And by the way, that would only bring the United States up to par with about 171 other nations.
Well, just to take us a little further, because I know you've done some, you and some other people at some mm-hmm. other universities have,
right.
have looked at this. The proponents say if workers say they want to unionize, that should be enough, and that the current rules create a situation where employers can pressure workers. The opponents say, essentially, they say the opposite. They say it creates a situation where the union organizers can pressure workers, and they also say that the signing of the cards doesn't protect workers' privacy. That's always one of the big arguments that gets made. So you directed this study. It involved four universities in four different states, New York, New Jersey, Illinois, and Oregon, where something like the Free Choice Act already exists for public sector workers. And you looked at this, at these very questions about, you know, what it is that people who favor this and who oppose it, and all this business about is there coercion and how does this work. So what did you find?
Sure. Well, what we found when we actually looked at data, we didn't rely on interviews, we didn't rely on anecdotes or subjective interpretations or accusations. We actually went into a number of different state files where there were databases that had a record of organizing through a card check process for public sector workers. We looked at all of those files, and we looked for cases. We looked to see what, in fact, was the experience. Were there cases of fraud and intimidation? And cases of fraud and intimidation, as the employer claims, can be brought by the individual worker or the employer in these states, and would also be true under the national law. So we have an experiment that we can do to try to bring some data and some hard evidence to the debate. And what we found in these four states was that incredibly, in thousands of cases in which drives had occurred, the vast majority that were successful, some that weren't successful, but we could only find five cases of alleged union coercion or fraud in these four states, covering roughly the same years going back to early part of 2000, 2002, 2003 through 2009. So we're talking about 6 years, five states, thousands of cases. We could only find five allegations. And when those allegations were investigated, I believe we found one recorded case of something that met the standard of union abuse or fraud. So if, in fact, there, it's true, as the employer says, that there would be systematic abuse, then this data in the public sector, and it's the only real data that anybody has to work with. Well, there is some private sector studies, actually, that have been done that have and their findings have paralleled ours, but principally our data set was the best record of what actually happens, and it runs completely contrary to the claims of the employer. Well, that's not to that's not to suggest that there isn't persuasion or that people don't feel some pressure or they don't feel a pull to support a cause. But that's no different, quite frankly, than what happens in civic elections. And frankly, it's far less assertive or interruptive than what we know through National Labor Relations Board studies employers have done to workers who have shown an indication that they wanted to join a union. And if we had the time, we could talk about the data that shows what percentage of workers who are active in a union organizing drive get fired, and what the level of employer abuse in organizing is, and it's at a ratio that is just legions beyond what would even be the wildest expectations about what unions are doing. So the point is, when you use the skills of a social scientist and you bring them to bear, that argument about union fraud and abuse is a canard. It's ideological. It's a political one. But sadly, I sometimes become a little saddened by the fact that the data doesn't seem to matter.
Our guest in this hour, Bob Bruno, is associate professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois Chicago, and has done a lot of research on working class and union studies issues, and also teaches courses on things like labor politics, labor and politics, labor history, collective bargaining, and we're talking about organized labor here in the United States. Questions, welcome. We have somebody ready to go. We are short on time, but we'll try and get in as many callers as we can. If we have some other folks, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Piatone, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I kind of disagree a little bit with you on the issue of forcing somebody or not forcing somebody. I think it is kind of a bad scenario that you'd have to vote twice. I think voting once, and I used to be in the union long way back when. I'm in the trades. I know a lot of people that are in the union, and a lot of the people I talk to now is a little bit of discontent. They won't say too much outside of the thing. When their jobs are at stake and the amount of money that some of these people are getting paid to do the same job, say for instance I am, it's just insane. It's ridiculous. We've gone down to 1980s levels pay, so somewhere somebody's got to give. And I know in the private sector, as far as like corporate, some retail giants and whatnot, they've tried to keep people out labor-wise. And I can understand the reasoning behind it because I'm a small business owner. The last thing I want is somebody telling me what I should pay or I shouldn't pay a client, and I don't know what. That's just the way the economy is now. It's just insane what they're asking. But anyway, I'll get off.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a whole lot of points there that we won't have time to address. But they're the sort of points that have been made historically, speaking to the charge that a union might be too expensive for an employer and would then damage the employer's profitability or ability to produce. And in the short time that we have, I would simply note for the caller that there have been studies that have examined union versus non-union employers controlling for all the other variables. What has been found is that in unionized settings, there is a much higher level of productivity, there's a much higher level of efficiency There are fewer disputes. The cost of dealing with the disputes is less. There are higher trained workers, and this is particularly true in the construction industry. There are fewer injuries. Working compensation costs are thereby lower. Quality of work, again, is found to, on average, be higher. And that in settings where small employers, frankly, can afford a union package, it's actually the rare union that pursues organizing. The union understands that an employer has to have the capacity to pay, and that where employers have the capacity to pay, the unions ask for more. Where they have less capacity to pay, what we have found in studies that are now three decades old is that the unions recalibrate what their demands are. I guess the point is there actually is no evidence whatsoever, despite the sort of mythological belief out there that the UAW destroyed the American auto industry. There is simply no solid evidence that a trade union, certainly a national trade union in any particular market or industry, is responsible for destroying a otherwise profitable, good employer. The truth is, the labor movement has accommodated to capitalism in the United States. It was critical to saving capitalism in the 30s. It was critical to doing it again after World War II, and it very likely will be again that institution that will be at the center of revitalizing the economy. So, I mean, I hear the brothers' concerns and fears. The reality is, it's not the labor movement that's actually out there operating in society.
All right, let's get to another caller here, Chicago, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi, thank you.
Yes.
Well, if it was trade unions that destroyed the auto industry and the steel industry in America, then why do we have a viable steel and auto industry in Europe and Japan where they're all unionized?
Okay, wonderful point.
Plain terrible management that destroyed those industries. But what I wanted to kind of speak to the earlier caller's thing about the high wages and all that he was seeing his one industry in construction. And that's a lot of the problem of, I believe, that you have in the popular mind is that union workers are getting these outrageously high sums of money. And that gets you to the Carpenters Union. The vast majority of unionized workers in America do not make particularly high wages. The public sort of sees people running a bulldozer or, it's a visible job, and they hear their friends who are in unions bragging about the big money they make 6 months out of the year, the rest of the time they're laid off. And so that kind of comes to mind as the typical union job. But most union jobs pay far less than that. There's thousands and thousands of union jobs in America where people are making less than $10 an hour, maybe $12 an hour. The one thing they have that the non-unionized workers have is they have representation of the union. It's a lot harder to get fired. You can't simply be fired on the whim of your boss. Mm-hmm. You have some recourse. You have some representation if somebody's trying to fire you for unjust reason. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot of the reason that there's sort of this mythology and not people that are unfamiliar with unionized jobs. And then you have, this kind of mythology of the tough guys with baseball bats. Well, the fact of the matter is that the violence, that 99% of the violence that's been committed in union situations over years has been perpetrated by the companies. And Pinkertons, mm-hmm. U.S. Army, it's not union people. The unions are in a totally defensive situation at this point. And like you pointed out, if there's going to be any revival of the middle class in this country, it's going to be because more people join unions. Without it, just a race to the bottom. How far can they push all our jobs down?
I've got nothing to add. If that's the last point, that was I couldn't have said it any better.
Well, this we're down here. We just have a couple of minutes left. I guess I find myself going back to the numbers. If you look at the percentage of the U.S. workforce that was unionized back, say, in the early 80s, it was a little over 20%, mm-hmm. and now it's a little over 12%. And so you wonder, well, exactly what sort of potential there is for growth since there's been so much shrinkage. And then what are the consequences of the fact that so much of the American population, they're not unionized, there may not be in their family any history of connections with unions. They may not know people who are union members. And so that there's also this gulf, this sort of conceptual gulf between people who are union members and those people who aren't.
Yeah, no, well, those are good points, frankly, Dave, and challenges. What I would note is that there have been, numerous times. In fact, there probably hasn't been a time in which it's sort of it's been ideal necessarily to join a union, or easy to join a union, or the culture has been so encouraging and embracing of the labor movement. Although public opinion for most of American history in the 20th century, anyway, according to Gallup, shows that there is broad approval for the labor movement. But what's critical is that work kills. Work can be abusive. Employers can act in destructive, irrational ways. And when they do that, it creates a grievance. It may take years. It might take decades. But in that soil is flowering a revolt. And it happened in the late 19th century. It happened at the turn of the century. It happened in the 1930s. It happened after World War II. It happened again, actually, in the early part of the 1970s. So, in terms of an historical timeline, it's not that sort of long since labor has resurged. So as long as the economic system generates abuse and injustice, the labor movement is going to be needed. Now, having said that, it's going to need leaders. It's going to need creativity. It's going to need vitality. It's going to need some visionary thinking. It's going to have to understand the role that an SEIU plays along with the industrial unions. They will have to move together. But one final point about the potential here, studies that were done no more than 5-6 years ago demonstrated that if, in fact, non-union workers could join a union without getting abused by their employer or without fear of being fired, and close to 25,000-30,000 are fired every year for just saying that they or leading a union drive, that if they, in other words, they had a law that would protect them, that we would raise union density from this 12.7% spot where we are, that we would raise it upwards of 30%, and that would bring us back to the halcyon days of the mid-1950s when over a third of the labor force was unionized. So there's potential there, and as it's always been the case, the best organizer for the labor movement is a bad employer, and sadly there are too many who are not properly treating their work as well or providing for them.
Well, there we will have to finish up with our thanks to the guest, Bob Bruno. He is Associate Professor in the School of Labor and Employment Relations, Director of the Labor Education Program, U of I Chicago. Professor Bruno, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local Farmers Market at the Square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets, downtown Urbana. Information at 384-2444.
WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication.
We will break for an update on the markets and news, then there'll be more of Focus. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right out to the pits and look at the current prices. In Kansas City, July wheat at $5.75 is down 6 1/4. September, $5.11 1/4, down 7 1/2. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, $4.84 3/4, down 6 3/4. May corn, $3.71, down 3/4. July, $3.76 3/4, down 1 1/2. September, $3.84, down 1/4. December, $3.93, up 1/2. March of 2011, $4.05, up 3/4. May soybeans are not trading in the pit. The July